You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Break a Bat podcast, where baseball meets Broadway. An attempt to show that my two favorite mediums don't have to live in such separate worlds and maybe even break some stigmas. We're happy to have you with us. Now let's play ball. Hello and welcome to Break a Bat, where baseball meets Broadway and sports meets show business. This is Al Malafronte coming at you for the Broadway Podcast Network. First and foremost, I hope everyone in our audience was able to get through this crazy series of storms that we've been dealing with throughout the country. I was very happy to see some of our dedicated listeners like Bob Warren mark himself safe from Hurricane Ida down in New Orleans. I hope this show can provide some bit of an escape from all the craziness that we're dealing with in the world at large. So again, my best wishes to all of you and your families. This is going to be a cool episode as we head back to the stadium tonight and welcome in a former Major League All-Star whose big league career spanned 9 seasons. A key cog for the Oakland A's from 1997 to 2000, my guest tonight was not only one of the best offensive outfielders in the AL West during that period, but also someone who was instrumental in helping return the Oakland A's franchise into a powerhouse. His career is highlighted by a Rookie of the Year award in 1998, a 104 RBI season, and of course, he played a big role in helping the A's break an 8-year playoff drought when they won the American League West in 2000. We're so grateful he could join us tonight. So with that being said, I ask you all to please turn your attention to home plate. Just beyond the marquee, now batting, Ben Grieve. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Al. Appreciate it. And appreciate the introduction, too.
My pleasure. Did it take you back to Bob Shepard at all when you would come visit Yankee Stadium?
You know, that's funny you say that, because my dad, one of his favorite stories is because when he used to play is about Bob Shepard and just that classic voice. He tells it way better than I do. But basically, his favorite player was Mickey Mantle. And the first time he heard his name announced to when he played there, the first time he heard his own name announced, and then when I played there to be in the stands and hear my name announced all by Bob Shepard is, I think that's one of the highlights of his baseball memory bank.
That is so surreal. Did you used to get pumped up coming to Yankee Stadium?
Yeah. You know, when people ask me my favorite parks, all the new ones are nice. I mean, they're all good, but my favorite parks to play in were Fenway, Yankee Stadium. And surprisingly enough, might've been my favorite one was Old Tiger Stadium, and then, Wrigley too. But I love the old parks, just the history, and, they're probably not as good to watch a game in, but to play the game, I love playing in all those parks.
Now, are you surprised that, I mean, obviously they've kept Fenway around, they've kept Wrigley around, a lot of history there. They built a new Yankee Stadium. Does it surprise you at all that there's no new Oakland Coliseum yet?
It does. And I know they've been trying up there. I'm not sure where they're at with it right now, but they desperately need a new park. As nice as the weather is out there, it's a great place to watch baseball. They put a good team out there every year. A park would be so nice for them to have.
Now, what are you up to in retirement, Ben?
I don't do much. I golf, watch sports on TV, and I have 3 kids that are all still at the house. So my oldest is 18, my daughter is 16, and my youngest is 11. So when they get out of the house, I'm sure I'll find something to do, but they keep me busy for now.
Yeah, I can imagine. And, you know, you mentioned watching sports on TV. Are you still keeping up with baseball?
Yeah, I'm kind of a fantasy sports nerd. It keeps me in touch with some of my old buddies is the best part about it. It makes me watch too much TV is probably the downside. So I follow sports mainly because I'm in some of these little stupid fantasy leagues. But yeah, I got a baseball one, so I'm kind of on top of who's where.
Now, are these all your old former teammates, and you guys are drafting today's players?
So yeah, I had a football draft today, actually, that started when I was on the Brewers in 2004. That's been going on this long. Most of the guys are still in it. A lot of the same guys, a couple have come, and Jeff Jenkins started it, left, came back and left again. But for the most part, it's a bunch of former Brewers. Yeah.
Wow. So I'm trying to think about those teams. You were there. What was that? So you went from Oakland to Tampa, then to Milwaukee. Is that how that played out?
Yeah. I signed with Milwaukee for the 2004 season and was just there that one season. And then I got traded to the Cubs at the end of that season and finished my career out with the Cubs. So yeah, the 2004 Brewers, it's like Bill Hall, Craig Counsell was our shortstop, Wes Helms, Jeff Jenkins, Lyle Overbay, and Ben Sheets was probably our biggest name then.
04 Brewers, was Richie Sexton on that team too, or was he gone by then?
I think he was there the year before, because he was in that league that we must have continued it from the year before. Yes, Richie, I'm trying to think who else. Junior Spivey, these are kind of names.
Former All-Star,
yeah. We had a good team. We weren't as good as the Cubs that year.
Now, Ben, when I think back on your career, obviously I mentioned your time with the Oakland A's. I have to know this. Being a first-round draft pick, you were obviously under a huge microscope from the second you got called up, drafted second overall. Is it tough to break into the big leagues under those types of circumstances?
In a way, it can be if you look at it from that standpoint. I never really thought about it much. The advantage you have over the late-round picks is if you do struggle in the minor leagues, you got a longer rope. I didn't matter to me. I always did fairly well at each league. But for the later round picks, if you have a bad season, a lot of times that's it. Like, you're not back the next season. So in a way, it could be less pressure just knowing that you don't have to perform, that you're going to have a job the next year on a team. But, you know, like you said, everyone's expecting you to do something when you step to the plate. More eyes are watching you. So it could go both ways.
You know, you had Willie McCovey hyping you up back when you were a rookie, and you actually responded. How surreal is it to be a rookie and have that type of not only hype, but success almost immediately? Do you feel like a rock star?
Well, I like playing in Oakland because it wasn't the New York media. It wasn't the Boston media, Philadelphia. You know, as a player, you can say all you want. Like, I don't read the paper. It was the paper back then. I don't read the paper. I don't watch the news. But you feel pressure if you're not performing in those cities way more than you do in places like Oakland or Tampa or San Diego. So having a good season your first year, especially when you're expected to have a good season, you know, at the end of the year, I think I kind of like relax a little and like, okay, got that one in the books. But during the season, you're grinding, you know, it's playing every day. You're not really thinking about it.
Now, how'd you find out you were going to be an All-Star in 98?
I wasn't really expecting it. I wasn't voted in. I was, Mike Hargrove was the manager. And he selected me, which is kind of cool when someone else that you don't even play for picks you. A couple of days before the game, Art Howe just called me in and told me, and you know, the team is happy for you. I think that year I was the only Oakland A. It would have been nicer to have some teammates there. It would have been funner, but I think the next year we sent a few more.
Yeah, that's right. When you had like Giambi and John Jaha and some of those lines.
Yeah, that's a good memory.
Yeah,
Isringhausen, Tim Hudson. Yeah,
that's right. Zito 99 or 2000? He played with you though, right? Zito.
Yeah, there. He got called up. Hudson got called up first, and then Zito and Mulder. I'm not sure the order, but Tim Hudson was there almost from the beginning of 99, and I think Zito was a little later. Yeah.
You know, it's so interesting because you guys, most of you, all got called up around the same time. I know Giambi was there for a little while before you got there, but it seems like you all had success almost immediately. It was like there was no learning curve. Did you guys like know you were studs at that time that you were able to just like turn it on the high, on the, you know, the brightest of lights or under the brightest of lights like that?
Well, the best part about Oakland, was the team in the clubhouse. And the leader of our team was Jason, Giambi. And so we had the most relaxed, fun atmosphere you could imagine. I'm sure there's more teams like it, but I can't imagine there was a better situation as a rookie to come into than that one, just as far as the looseness and the, just the play hard and see what happens mentality that we had there.
Yeah. I mean, it was such a quick transformation, because when you first got called up, like in 97, I know you had a cup of coffee with the A's, they were struggling. It had been like quite a few years. What was so different about the 2000 team, for example, that you were finally able to get over that hump?
That's a good question. And I'm trying to remember. It had to be the pitching. I mean, I don't think Tim Hudson was like a seventh round pick, eighth round pick, and nobody was counting on him to be a potential Cy Young winner at that point. And so that is always the first thing, is you got to have good pitching. And trying to think back to who our staff was that year. But, you know, we made a trade for I don't know if we traded him or just had Gil Heredia. I don't know if you remember that name. He pitched really good for us. Our bullpen threw really well. We had guys out there that most people wouldn't remember their names. Jim Messier, Jeff Tam, these guys in our bullpen that had outstanding years. And Billy Bean made a trade late in the season. We traded Billy Taylor and someone else, maybe Kenny Rogers, to the Mets. And Kenny was a good pitcher for us. And we got Terrence Long, Jason Isringhausen, and someone else. And those guys were great for us. Izzy was a great closer. Billy Taylor was a good closer too, but Izzy was young and came in and slammed the door for us. So that trade helped us a lot too.
Now, you had your best season in 2000. I know you won Rookie of the Year in 98, but you know, if you look at your overall numbers, you ever feel overmatched playing in the steroid era?
That's a good question. I just felt unlucky to play in the steroid era because I didn't take them. And I was playing with guys back then. You didn't really think about it. You kind of looked at certain guys and were like, really? But to hit 29 home runs when I was a kid growing up, that was pretty high. I remember like one year, I think as a kid, George Bell led the league with 40. So 29, that's a lot. In the 80s, it wasn't a lot in the 90s. 29 compared to 73 doesn't look so great. So I just felt it was unlucky. And, I don't know how many of the pitchers were taken or if that helped that much for them. But to be the guy, and, you know, obviously not everyone took them. So there's other guys like me that numbers would have looked a lot better. But to be the one that wasn't taking them, it just was an unlucky time to play.
Was it discouraging at all?
No, I didn't think about it that way. The reason I never took them, aside from just values, is that I actually didn't think they would help me that much. I'm sure they would have, but I felt like when I took batting practice, like I was hitting it just as far as these guys. Like, okay, well, I don't need to hit it any farther. I just need to hit it better, you know, and more often. So, it wasn't discouraging, but... I'm sure we had some guys on our team that were taking it that were helping our team too. So you just kind of dealt with it back then. You didn't really think about it much, to be honest with you.
You didn't know that you had certain teammates, or did you ever see certain teammates doing stuff?
No, I never, because the guys that take them, they don't want people to know. It's like you're putting up these numbers. You don't want people to know that like you had help. So it's kind of like a forbidden thing that the guys that taken them, they didn't want people to know. And it turns out some of them got caught. Some of them were in the Mitchell report. And then, you know, you got others that skated through, I'm sure. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that what you were able to accomplish, considering the type of playing field that you were dealing with. I mean, yeah, if I look at your baseball reference, for example, this looks like a solid corner outfielder from the 1980s and then some. I mean, you had high OPSs, especially while you were playing with the Oakland A's. Why do you think that you did have that type of staying power? Like, what was it about your game that you feel made you so unique, especially, you know, in that scandalous era?
Well, the one thing I did well for Oakland and even for Tampa when I struggled, I was always able to get on base pretty regularly, which was probably my best attribute as a hitter, was having a patient and good eye at the plate. So that, you know, that got me on base a lot. But the one thing that if I did better, I would have stuck around longer, is when I struggled in Tampa and wasn't putting up the same numbers. And then towards the end of my career, if I could play a different position other than outfield or had a little more speed, it definitely helps. And I tell my kids that, like, don't just think you're one position, like learn to play multiple positions. And the guys like Chris Bryant, who can play third base, center field, right field, left field, first base. I don't know if he plays shortstop, but those guys are extremely valuable. I played right field and left field, so that didn't do me too much good whenever it came time to seeing what else I could do.
Now, you and Hal McCray used to clash a little bit. Is that right?
I liked Hal. You might be thinking of Pinella.
Once Hal McCray left. My bad. Okay. Yeah.
I loved Hal. Hal was great.
Character. Both characters, really. But Pinella, not difficult to play for?
Well, I don't know if you can search it on the internet and find video of it. I'm sure if it happened now, it would be out there. I had an incident when I was struggling. I came in and pinch hit for Carl Crawford in a game against the Yankees in the ninth inning. And Mariano Rivera was pitching. And he threw me a pitch on a 2-2 count that was, because, you know, he had the cutter that he would throw into lefties. But if he wanted to, he could throw that same cutter on the outside corner and spot it. And so I'm always thinking, okay, hit the inside pitch, Rivera. You know it's coming in. And he threw me a perfect strike on the outside corner, and the umpire called it a ball on 2-2. So I'm like, oh, okay, great. Get an extra pitch to see if I can break my bat against this guy. And so the next pitch, he throws a questionable strike up in the zone, and I took it, and it was probably a ball. But the pitch before was so perfect that the umpire called the next pitch a strike. And so I struck out and just turned back and went to the dugout. Lou from the dugout thought it was a ball. And he thought that, well, he asked me, he's like, was that a ball or a strike? And I'm like, I don't know. It might've been a ball. And so that comment led to him asking me, well, why the hell didn't you say something? Like, I can't do a Lou Piniella voice, but you can imagine. And whatever I said, he took it the wrong way. I said something like, nah, he doesn't care, or it doesn't matter. The umpire's walking off the field. I said something like that. And whatever he heard or whatever I said got understood as me not caring. And when he thought he heard that, he laid into me. It went from the dugout, up the ramp, into the clubhouse, in front of the whole team. And I'm a kind of shy guy. I just sat there and didn't say anything. I didn't yell back at him, like, try to punch him like Rob Dibble did.
Or like Reggie against Billy Martin. He played for Billy Martin. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They fought in the dugout, I think, didn't they?
Yeah. They didn't actually get, but they tried to, they almost got into a fist fight. Elston Howard got between them.
I remember John McLaren came up to me afterwards in the shower, and he's like, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, man, I'm all right. I'll be fine. The next day, Lou acted like it never happened. I was batting fifth or sixth, so just kind of forgot about it.
Oh, interesting. Wow.
But he liked the hard-nosed player and the loud, emotional player, because that's how he was. And that's fine. Every team has those guys, and I like watching those guys too. But I wasn't the loud, emotional, throw-your-helmet player. And I don't think Lou could understand how anyone could be that way.
All these years, I thought it was Hal McCray, which I guess would have made sense because he had a temper too. I mean, we've all seen the video, I think, by now, of him throwing the phone up in the air.
I think he realized very early in his Tampa managing career that he was going to have some patience. And I think he just understood that from the get-go.
Oh, my goodness. Now, Obviously, at least you went out a winner in Oakland. Can you tell me what's going through your mind when you head to the Bronx all tied up at a game apiece in that 2000 Division Series? You think you have a shot at the mighty Yankees at that point?
I'm trying to remember. I know we were flying back to Oakland and it was tied at 2-2. I can't remember how that each game went. I know we beat Roger.
Game four, you killed the Yankees to tie it
up. Okay, that was game four.
2-2, yeah. Right.
And I know Olmedo Saenz hit a big home run in one of those games. But I remember flying home to Oakland thinking, like, all right, like we're feeling pretty good going into game five. And I think Andy Pettit was pitching for the Yankees. And we got some runs, scored some runs off them, but I can't remember. I think early on in that game that the Yankees put up some runs and we kind of fought back, but not enough.
Yeah, the Yankees, I remember, scored 6 runs in that first inning. Like Tino hit that 3-run triple over Terrence Long's head, and you guys immediately put up a 5 spot. And I think Justice hit solo homer for the Yankees, and the Yankees won like 7-5. But yeah, that's right. It started off, it's like, oh, there's going to be a blowout, and you guys scratched and clawed all the way back.
It's funny what you remember, because the thing I remember most about that game is I went 0-for-4 with 4 strikeouts.
Against Pettit and El Duque, or did it end up with a Mariano strikeout?
Pettit for a couple. El Duque was one of them, and I think Stanton was mixed in there, I'm pretty sure. I'm not sure if it was him or not, but I'm pretty sure it was him. The thing about Andy Pettit, I never hit him that great, but early on in my career, or the first 2 years, I guess, that I faced him, it was fastball, curveball, slider. And to me, I don't think I saw too many changeups. So everything was either coming straight or going away from me. And I felt like I could have a game plan against that. But in 2000, and I don't know if he was doing this all along or he just started doing it to me, he started throwing a 2-seam fastball. And so now it's not straight and going away from me anymore. Now I got this other one to think about that's coming in on me. And once he started doing that, I was not going to hit well off him.
Right. Who was it? Oh, Mike Bordick actually said that was the toughest pitcher he ever faced. And you know, when you think, it's not that Andy Pettit was some overpowering guy. It's just that manipulation that he had with this cutter all of a sudden towards the end.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah. Andy Pettit
had the glove in front of his face, like, yes. This. So kind of like, oof,
the stare. Oh man. Ben, all these years later, has it been tough to watch the game change the way it has to, you know, this kind of 3 true outcome, 5 inning starts, the 5 and dive thing, you know, the crazy bullpen, you know, usage. What do you think of the way it's changed?
Yeah, it is. It's definitely different now. With all this, whatever you call it, the metrics, the launch angle and the spin rate and all that. I was kind of hoping when they got rid of that sticky substance and they started doing that the hitters would kind of make a resurgence. But you're right. What are the 3 outcomes? Home run, walk, and strikeout.
Yeah.
It's, you know, when you go to Padre games, there's not as many hits. Most of the runs are scored by home run, which is great. But, you know, I guess it takes some getting used to the new strategy. The one thing I hate, and I would have definitely hated it when I played, is the shift. I am not a fan of the shift. And I don't know if you've seen where Manny Machado plays out here sometimes. He's basically right in front of the right fielder. So as a left-hand hitter, if you don't hit the ball the other way, I imagine there's a lot of frustration going around these left-hand hitters.
Now, Ben, you were certainly a great left-handed hitter, and you accomplished a lot, but now it's about to get tough here on Break a Bat because we do a little segment where you picture yourself back in the batter's box in the 9th inning. Maybe Chapman is pitching, throwing 105 miles an hour, and I'll ask you a question. You got to think quick and tell me the first thing that comes to your mind. How does that sound?
Okay. Hopefully something comes to my mind.
Okay. What's I'm your ready. Favorite? All right, let's do it. Favorite New York City meal?
I can tell you my favorite restaurant. I don't think it's around anymore. It's Pino's. It's an Italian place that a guy named Jerry Casale used to own. I think he was a pitcher for the Red Sox. And I remember they had good lasagna. So I'll go with lasagna.
Toughest pitcher you ever faced?
Randy Johnson.
How about a guy you owned?
Guy you never heard of, Matt Parisho.
I have. I'm surprised. I've heard of Matt Tam, who you mentioned before, or was it Jeff Tam?
Jeff Tam. Let me give you one. I've heard of. I didn't own him, but I actually did better than most guys did against Roger Clemens. I definitely did not own him though, but I did better than most.
Most fun big league game you ever got to play in?
I guess I'd say the All-Star game and my first game back at Texas, where I grew up watching the Rangers.
You can be the lead in one Broadway musical. What would it be?
Let me think if I can name one. What's the one with 80s music?
Rock of Ages.
I'm a fan of 80s music, definitely. So I don't know anything about Rock of Ages, but I'll go with that one.
You know, they made a movie version with Julianne Hough and Tom Cruise, Russell Brand. Maybe you should watch it. You know, you can rehearse it.
I know my wife has seen it. Maybe I'll check it out.
Highly recommend it. Teammates of yours that would make the best Timon and Pumbaa in The Lion King on Broadway.
Oh, my God. Are those enemies of each other? Or are they, what are they, lion?
They're pals. They're the ones that, like, you know, do the whole Hakuna Matata. The warthog and the meerkat.
Are they like happy-go-lucky, good-natured characters?
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they are.
All right, I'll go Miguel Tejada and Jorge Valandia. I don't know if you know him. He's an assistant GM for the Phillies, but he is an infielder for the A's.
So if you had an evil teammate, we could call. Did you have any evil teammates? Because we could just say that we could cast them as Scar in the Lion King.
Let me think if I had any guys that were mean. It would probably be a pitcher. I played with a bunch of nice guys.
Zito's like a pretty chill dude, and Tim Hudson seems like a great guy.
Yeah, I didn't have any too intimidating. I guess a villain would be someone that the fans end up turning on in Chicago was Sammy Sosa, who I loved. It was a great teammate, but he turned into kind of a villain in Chicago.
Speaking of villains and fans turning on people, what are your thoughts on Alex Rodriguez?
I like Alex. When I do watch games, I don't always have the volume up, but I think he's a pretty good announcer. The thing about the guys that got caught taking steroids is, I can think of two examples. Andy Pettit was HGH and immediately just said he was sorry. Jason Giambi is another one. Immediately just said, hey, take accountability. I'm sorry. Those two guys, like, you know, it looked bad, but what else can you say to them? You know, they admitted it. They're wrong and life moves on. I remember Alex kind of shifted the blame on someone else. I don't remember exactly who it was or what he said, but I don't know. I can't really question or call someone on it. Maybe he's telling the truth. I don't know. But I think the guys that took steroids, if they just said, I'm not going to do it again. I'm going to move on. Sorry. Apologize. I think that would have been a lot better way to handle that than whatever they all said, or whatever the excuses were, or the blame was, but I think if he would have done that, I think people would have instantly forgave him and moved on with his career a little bit easier. But he's a nice guy. And I always, lately, since I have kids now, they love going to the games and getting autographs. And when I was a player, I didn't really think about it too much. You know, I'd sign autographs, but I didn't realize how much it meant to, like, kids to get a big leaguer's autograph. And my kids, some of their favorite players are just the random guys that signed an autograph for them. So I was staying at a hotel in Chicago watching Cubs game after we were playing, and the Yankees were staying at our hotel. And I saw Alex, and I never played with Alex, but we know each other, in the lobby. He came over and talked to me, met my oldest son, Bodie, talked to Bodie, and signed Bodie's baseball card. So I like Alex.
Okay, fair enough. It's
for that reason only, he signed my son's card and was really nice to him. So I'm a fan of Alex.
Good enough reason for me. Coolest piece of memorabilia that you kept from your playing career?
Oh, I got a good one. Does it have to be from my playing career? Can it be from when I was a kid?
Yeah, from when you were a kid, that's fine.
My dad went to game one of the 1988 World Series and kept an uncut ticket stub and gave it to me. And nowadays, they don't have tickets. You just scan your phone. So I got game one ticket of the 1988 World Series, and I just realized I had it the other day. I found it in a box. So I mailed it to my dad at the beginning of the season and said, if you can, if it's at all possible, because he's the Rangers announcer, can you try to get Dennis Eckersley and Kirk Gibson to sign this ticket? Obviously, they were part of that game. He's gotten Eckersley so far, but not Gibson. So if he gets that ticket signed by Kirk Gibson, that'll be by far the coolest thing that I own.
That's pretty cool as it is, the fact that you have that ticket stuff. But man, if you could get both those guys on that ticket, that you gotta hang that up on the wall.
I will for sure. Yeah, it's a good one.
All right, and here's a fun one here. Fact about Ben Grieve that would surprise people the most.
Huh. Fact about Ben Grieve that would surprise people the most. I don't know. Stump me on that one. I'm trying to think of something that I'm scared of I don't know. I can't think of anything great for that one. I'm kind of a sissy when it comes to most things as far as riding roller coasters and stuff like that. I'm definitely not a daredevil, but I don't think that would surprise anyone.
All right, Ben, this is the last one. What is the best piece of advice anyone ever gave you?
It's kind of a cliche, but when I was a kid, my dad, the only advice he ever gave me was play hard and have fun. And that's what I tell my kids, play hard and have fun. It's a pretty simple piece of advice, but it's also good advice.
Awesome stuff, Ben. Oh, man, this was so great chatting with you today, man. I hope to see you around the new Yankee Stadium soon. Have you had the chance to check it out yet?
I would love to come up and check it out. I haven't been up there yet. My parents and their family all live back east. They're from Massachusetts. So the last time I was in New England was at my grandfather's 90th birthday in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. But maybe one of these days I'll make it back to New York.
That'd be awesome, man. At the very least, I'll come back out to Petco Park, my favorite ballpark, and I'll say hello to you over there. All right.
Yeah, that'd be a good spot to visit in the winter in New York for sure.
Yeah, well, you're a lucky guy. I know we've got a few rough months ahead of us, but yes, you're very lucky to be living where you are down in San Diego. And man, I can't thank you enough for joining us tonight. This was great.
It's my pleasure, Al. I appreciate you having me. I'm glad I did it.
My pleasure, man. And thank you to all the folks at home who listened to Break a Bat tonight. Be sure to visit and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. This is Al Malafronte signing off from the Broadway Podcast Network. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to Break a Bat. This is produced by the fine folks at the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit and subscribe at bpn.fm/breakabat. You can find me online at break_a_bat_podcast. And you can also find the Broadway Podcast Network on Instagram at Broadway Podcast Network. It's been so great having you here with us today, and we'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.